Thanks, Anton, Yongbek, Tim Yinchen, so all the organizers for this opportunity to present some of the work that we've been doing in my group for the last year or year and a half. And so what I'll talk about, in the first half is, tied to sort of octopolar order and the origins of octopolar order and what, this connections with other research that's been going on in this area. And then I'll kind of towards the end mention some very recent work we've been doing on connections with how one might tune these things towards quantum criticality. So that's going to be the plan for the talk. And feel free to just unmute yourselves and ask questions during the talk. That's fine. So this was actually, let me begin by thanking the collaborators on this work. So this actually got started with conversations with Bruce Gollin at one of the kind of last CIFAR meetings and quantum materials CIFAR meetings. And so we kind of had very close interactions with them, with Bruce and his group, including his student Dadini, and later on with Graham Luke. And some of the initial work was kind of done with them. And then the more recent work on this quantum phase transitions and more microscopics was done with my PhD student Srikar and a fantastic postdoc Arijit, who's been in the group for about a year. And these are just some references for people who want to look back at it later. All right, so let's begin by sort of asking sort of what are multipolar orders. So the forms of magnetism that we are kind of familiar with typically are the conventional dipolar orders, which can take on various forms. So one can have kind of ferromagnets, which are most easily manifest as a macroscopic observable, whereas if they can, of course, align in other forms where you can have antiferromagnets. And of course, there's a lot of interest in asking, can one go beyond this and think about liquid-like states of these moments? There's a huge area of research on quantum spin liquids in these systems. Multipole orders refers to things where you can have higher than dipole moment order. And typically these arise when we take the spin of the electron and combine it with the orbital angular momentum present for atoms in a solid. And in these cases, as is kind of illustrated, as a cartoon here, the wave function of the electron has both orbital character, which is kind of illustrated by the shape of this wave function, and a color here that is supposed to indicate sort of how much of it is spin up and spin down. So there is some linear combination of, or some combination of spin and orbital degrees of freedom that plays a role in driving the ordering systems. And as you can see already here, trying to probe these kinds of orders is, can be challenging because you have to uncover sort of multiple degrees of freedom that have gotten entangled into forming these kinds of states. And in fact, there is a huge amount of research on this in the context of the heavy fermion systems where spin orbit coupling that drives this entanglement is extremely strong. And so there's a huge amount of work on the so-called hidden order phases in systems like the 5F actinides, including uranium and neptunium compounds. And there's been a huge amount of work in the past many years on these systems. So we can sort of ask, what is so different about heavy fermions and the transition metal systems that I'll discuss in today's talk. And really, it's only a question of scales in some sense, right? So we are talking about, the Hubbard repulsion or the local atomic repulsion scales are very similar. The main difference with respect to, heavy fermions and transition metal systems is really, or d-orbital transition metal system is really in the strength of the spin orbit coupling, which is, far more important in these actinides. And it's kind of a weaker scale compared to the crystal field environment for these d-orbital systems. But qualitatively, they all have the similar ingredients. And so one can ask whether, other systems can also exhibit the physics of heavy fermion materials. Okay. And so that's going to be part of the motivation for thinking about this physics. So if you think about the simplest systems where multiple orders appear, in fact, there's been a lot of work on, going back to several years, thinking about, you know, toy models of magnetic degrees of freedom, which are higher than spin half. So if you have a spin one spin model, for example, we know that we can write down, you know, 9 local, you know, Hermitian operators. One of them is the identity. So if you want to think about, you know, what, you know, order parameters you could sort of generate on a site, you can sort of generate dipole order parameters, which are just the usual spin operators. But of course, there's been a work on trying to ask, you know, can one stabilize quadrupole order, which involves bilinears of the spin operator, which then does not break time reversal symmetry when it orders. And there's some very nice work, you know, thinking about this in the context of spin one, spin chains, where in addition to the usual Heisenberg, one has biquadratic interactions, and there's a very rich phase diagram as one tunes the relative strength of these two, including in one dimension, possibly, you know, these kinds of critical quadrupolar correlations in the system. And so that was kind of, you know, probably among the earliest, you know, models that were studied for these. But there's been a lot of work since then thinking about this in the context of spin one magnets in two dimensions, and some very recent, you know, not so long ago work on thinking about this in the context of ion selenide and so on. So how do these moments actually arise in systems that I'll be talking about today? Is to think about, if you want to think about the atomic physics of these systems, one starts with, you know, a d orbital levels and splits it with a very large crystal field splitting coming from the octahedral environment present in the system into a T2G manifold, which carries an effective orbital angular momentum 1. And an EG doublet, which typically we kind of ignore, and I'll kind of say a bit later about why this can be dangerous in some way. Well, dangerous in the sense that you can sort of, some of the physics might get dropped if you do this. Okay, but this is what is typically done, and you start with this angular momentum, single particle angular momentum L equal to 1, introduce spin orbit coupling, and that drives this further splitting of this into angular momentum 3/2, total angular momentum of the single particle levels with J3/2 and J1/2, which are now split by the spin orbit scale. So this, people have measured this using you know, inelastic X-ray scattering. So you kind of come and see, for example, if there is a T2G and EG, you can sort of see the splitting by, you know, doing a two photon process where you absorb a photon, emit a photon, and you kind of see this difference energy in the system shows up in spectroscopy, and you can sort of assign these various excitations that are seen at high energy to these kind of excitations between the T2G and EG levels. And you can then ask, well, you know, what happens if I put in not just one electron, if it's not just the single particle states here, what if I have multiple electrons at a site, then interactions between electrons become important. And in that case, one can actually do like a simple, you know, exact diagonalization calculation to compare model Hamiltonians of this, you know, described by these spin orbit couple levels with experimental data on 5D systems. And here I'm just showing like some work that we did where you can sort of use two simple parameters, the spin orbit strength and the interactions parameterized by the Hund's coupling, and you can sort of fit and kind of see that all these spectra seen in these different materials, 5D materials, can actually be recovered. So we have some understanding of, you know, the ground state and excitations at the single particle level, and here I'm kind of just you know, putting together all of these pieces of information. Okay. So what do we know about if I have 5 electrons on a given site? Then this is the example that's been most well studied in the context of realizing things like the Kitaev model physics or these kind of variants of the Hubbard model with spin orbit coupling. And here, you know, one thinks of, you know, this amounts to 5 electrons in the T2G, really amounts to a single hole. So it's really one particle physics in some sense that's driving the formation of this local degree of freedom. And now you can sort of turn on interactions and get kind of a rich variety of physics emerging in these systems. Okay. If you think about removing one electron from here, you can sort of go to the D4 system. And a D4 system, if you look back, really amounts to saying, well, you know, I'll take these 4 levels that the J3 have, and I'm going to completely fill up this and form some kind of a band insulator. And so this band insulator, it's not interesting by itself, but there's been work arguing that one can probably realize interesting, excitonic physics in these systems where you can create spin excitons and kind of look at spin orbit coupled excitons in these systems and ask what happens if they condense, and you can sort of think about effect of pressure and doping and so on. So there's been a lot of work on these systems. But the things that one might look at other fillings, and I'll kind of focus here on a specific filling with two electrons. But in these whole host of fillings, we see that the ground state has angular momentum bigger than half. So you can have either effective angular momentum 3/2 in these two cases, or an effective angular momentum 2 in this problem. And so these are candidates for realizing multipolar broken symmetries from spin-orbit entanglement. Okay. And so in fact, there has been work over a few years now thinking about this physics both in the context of metals as well as insulators. So in fact, there's this very nice work by Liang Fu proposing that one could realize instabilities of Fermi surfaces and spin-orbit coupled systems, which are different from what one expects in a system without spin-orbit coupling. In particular, you could have an example of quadrupolar order or some kind of a nematic order where you break directional symmetry by, let's say, picking one plane. So imagine you have a spherical Fermi surface and you can sort of select out one plane or pick a director which is kind of normal to the plane. And in a typical system, you might say, well, the way I'm going to create these kind of nematic order parameters is to look at products of momenta. So you can construct order parameters proportional to, for example, kx times ky with appropriate sort of electron operators stuck in. But kx times ky or symmetrized ky times kx. But in spin-orbit coupled systems, you're also allowed order parameters of this sort where one component is coming from the momentum and a second from the spin. And unusual about this is the fact that these kinds of order parameters not only break directional symmetry, but they also break inversion. And so there's been some very nice work from David Shea's group kind of looking for this inversion breaking in second harmonic generation in some of these systems, notably these pyrochlore 227 compounds. In insulators, really quadrupolar order, in some ways you can think of it as orbital order, crudely speaking, right? So if there are these systems where there are these so-called double perovskites, and I'll kind of talk about them more in the talk. There are these compounds where rhenium has one electron in the d orbital. So if I kind of go back, it's this example here where you have a j equal to 3/2 degree of freedom. And now you can kind of look for phase transitions in that manifold, and some very recent experiments and some very early theory from Gang Chen, Rodrigo Gang Chen, Leon, and also from Ohio State group, Randeria Trivedi and others had suggested that there could be both coexistence of orbital order in these systems together with magnetic order. And there has been some very recent work from Zenji Hiroi's group where they have kind of isolated these two transitions through sort of looking at signatures in X-ray diffraction and doing polarization analysis. So there is some evidence for this kind of quadrupolar order of the J3 half, which amounts in some sense to having coexistence of orbital order and magnetic order. So with that introduction, what I wanted to turn to is kind of talk about an example of what one might call hidden order in a class of Mott insulators with osmium, where there were some very nice experiments from the McMaster group, so Bruce Gollin, John Greeden, Graham Duke, and others looking at these class of double perovskite materials. And so these systems are, systems composed of, so the barium and oxygen are basically not doing very much. Magnesium is this pink, cage here, and the blue cage is osmium, and here it's magnesium, calcium, or zinc, one of these three. And these, you can see, are really correspond to these magnetically important degrees of freedom, are the osmium sites, and they live on an FCC lattice. So it's a checkerboard crystal in three dimensions, where alternate sites of the cubic lattice are occupied by one or the other. And the one sublattice of that forms an FCC lattice of these osmium ions. This was thought to be an interesting example of magnetism with two electrons in the d orbital, where this type of analysis that I alluded to earlier would suggest that there should be a total angular momentum J equal to 2 degree of freedom. Right? So one expects that one can have a large class of broken symmetries in this problem. And I'll kind of discuss some experimental observations and how one can sort of think about this. Okay. So let me then go over some of the data that they had obtained on these systems. So this is again on a whole like three osmate compounds where they had done some of these measurements. So let me begin by talking about thermodynamics. So just specific heat. And more importantly, what we are looking for is kind of the entropy associated with this J equal to 2 degree of freedom. So you expect that there are five levels. And so what we are looking for to see if this is in fact a correct scenario is to see that there is a log five entropy at high temperature. So this shows the specific heat as a function of temperature in these systems, and the red and blue are simply the magnetic system and a reference compound here. And if you subtract, you can sort of plot out the specific heat, and you see that there's a single transition associated with this peak here at about 50 Kelvin in this compound. And you can now take this and kind of try and extract the entropy from the area under the C over T curve. And what is found is that in all these systems they had seen, ignore this very low temperature physics, which is some impurity phase that they know exists in these systems at low temperature. But here you see that there is this huge entropy, which is the area under this curve. And the area under the curve that they extract is far short of what you get from log five. Okay, so I didn't put the number here. Sorry, I should move this out of this. But it's far short of what you expect from a log five entropy. So log two would be like 5.8, log three is already 9.1. And so the things that you're seeing here, numbers that you see here are, closer to log two rather than log five. So clearly this says that, maybe this physics is not the correct physics. Maybe something else is going on here that you don't understand. So the second thing you can ask is, maybe part of the entropy got lost. Maybe you didn't see this entropy because somehow this five-fold degeneracy was broken by some symmetry breaking in the problem, right? Similar to in the J3 half example, we saw that there were two transitions. So maybe if one of these transitions happened at very, very high temperature, maybe symmetry was already broken, and that's why we are not seeing this log five entropy that we expect. To test that, Bruce's group did very high resolution X-ray measurement, diffraction measurements, trying to look for deviations from cubic symmetry, right? So nominally, they're supposed to be cubic, and you can ask, symmetry lowering will show up if there is some kind of orbital order, for instance. And they find that, so the black here is the data in these systems, and the blue and red curves show simulations for what the curve, what this diffraction signal would have looked like, assuming some tiny distortion. So imagine there was a 0.1% distortion from cubic symmetry. It already produces a visible change in the diffraction signal. So what this amounts to saying is that to a very, very high degree of accuracy, in fact, the system remains cubic down to the lowest temperatures. And these are, well below the transition 50 Kelvin transition. So these are all done at 20 Kelvin, these experiments. Okay. So this tells us, the system stays cubic. There is no lattice symmetry breaking, but there is signatures of time reversal symmetry breaking in these systems. So if you do mu SR, so you kind of implant muons and you're looking at sort of the asymmetry signal, And what you find is once you go below the transition temperature, so here, you know, 50, 45 Kelvin roughly is the transition, you begin to see the emergence of oscillations in the signal, suggesting that there is actually time reversal symmetry breaking going on. And the internal fields that one estimates, here are on the scale of, you know, tens of Gauss, maybe like 30, 40, 50 Gauss, something of that order in these systems. So in the first set of papers that they wrote, you know, including this one here, this was identified as a signature of magnetic order in these systems. But you can ask, well, what is the signal you expect if, you know, what is the strength of these internal fields you would expect if there was, let's say, one Bohr magneton worth of ordering going on? And it turns out it's extremely small. So you would expect that a Bohr magneton worth of ordering would have given you a muon signal that was, you know, 10 times larger than this. Okay. So the only way to understand the signal within any conventional scenario of magnetic order would be to say that you've somehow fine-tuned and parked yourself very, very close to some magnetic critical point. And that's why you have some negligible, some very tiny ordered moment in the system. That's the only way you can get oscillations with this very, very large period or kind of this very small magnetic field. So what Bruce's group did was to actually then go and look for, you know, can one search for this neutron using neutron diffraction? Can one look for this magnetic signal? And of course, the best limit that they can get to, they don't find any signature of magnetic Bragg peaks in their experiments. You can put bounds on this, and the best bounds are in one of these compounds where it's about a 20th of a Bohr magneton, entirely consistent with this very small field seen in these mu SR experiments. Okay. So it tells you that, okay, you know, you actually have time reversal symmetry breaking, but it's probably nothing to do with dipole order in these systems. So something odd must be going on in the problem. Okay. They do see signatures in the inelastic spectrum, but if I look at excitations, there are signatures of magnetic excitation. So it's not that, you know, it's some experiment where nothing shows up. There are gapped magnetic excitations that are showing up in the inelastic neutron scattering. So with that, we kind of let me kind of then summarize the puzzles that one encounters in this, and you know why you might think that this is kind of like hidden order physics in some sense, which is that, you know, first the entropy that you recover is extremely small. There's no sign of a second transition or anything of that sort. System remains cubic but exhibits time reversal symmetry breaking, but yet there is no signature of anything in the. Are there things in the chat which I'm not seeing? If people are typing into the room.
I don't see any. There are no questions.
Okay. Sorry, I just heard some click, so I assumed that there was something in the chat. Sorry. So I can go back. Okay. All right. So what I'll kind of discuss over the next 10 minutes or so is really kind of how one resolves this system, and you know, what does this ordering really correspond to? And to do that, we can sort of look for the following, and this kind of an idea, and we'll see that it's kind of borne out. And the idea is to really think of this J equal to 2 degree of freedom that we have as an effective, you know, d orbital, right? So in some sense, we are saying, well, you know, I have a cubic system. It has some octahedral, you know, environment because of oxygens and so on this ion. And this really is like an effective d orbital. So the J equal to 2 is kind of like L equal to 2 in some sense. And so what you expect is that, in fact, this thing is going to be unstable. It's not unstable in the simplest setting where we take the T2G orbitals, you know, we say, well, the dominant crystal field has been taken into account, add in interactions, then you find that, in fact, there's a perfectly five-fold degenerate J equal to 2 manifold. But we expect that this is actually unstable to splitting in this environment, even in a cubic system. So why is this not seen? Our expectation is that, well, you know, maybe the resolution in this inelastic X-ray scattering experiments, typically it's on the scale of, you know, 30, 40 millivolts, depending on the ion. And so probably it's just not been resolved in X-ray scattering experiments. So if this happens, then you can ask, well, what is the thing that would make most sense with regard to the experiments? Okay. And the thing that makes most sense is to see that, you know, if this J equal to 2 splits in the following way, where it splits into, in some sense, a reverse splits compared to the usual crystal field, where this is like an EG type doublet, and that's a T2G triplet, except these are not, you know, pure orbital degrees of freedom, but they carry both spin and orbital angular momentum degrees of freedom. So this five-fold degenerate level, let's hypothesize for now that it actually splits into a doublet and triplet, but in reverse order. If we do this, then in fact, we can make sense of, you know, almost a big fraction of the data, right? And so let's start by, you know, thinking about, you know, what are the wave functions? So imagine this thing splits, you can sort of construct a cubic, you know, exactly in the spirit of heavy fermion systems, where you kind of write down some residual crystal field in this case in terms of orbital angular momentum degrees of freedom. And you can figure out that, you know, if you do that, you can write out the wave functions of this doublet and the wave functions of the triplet in the basis where I write it down, let's say in the JZ quantum numbers. These two form a non-Kramer's doublet. So one of them has, Leo.
Yeah, Arun, I have a question. I'm confused because I thought to get the J equals 2, you already took into account octahedral splitting, you know, in your T2G and EG basis. So why are you, correct. Why does it split again?
Yeah, so it looks like I'm doing double counting. And
yeah, somehow, maybe I'm being naive. But.
Yeah. No. It's perfectly fine. So in fact, what we found, so at this point, I'm kind of presenting it as if saying that, well, you know, maybe there's some residual effects that are not taken into account. And in fact, we've later found that the residual effects, and I'll kind of mention that in the next slide, really comes from the fact that this EG doublet that we threw away right at the beginning, in fact, that's not a good thing to do. So mm-hmm. if we strictly project at the outset to the T2G,
right,
throw away the EG doublet, the original EG that we had from the crystal fields, then it turns out that in fact, the J equal to 2 survives as a five-fold degenerate state. But it turns out that virtual excitations into the EG actually lead to a splitting of this. So that's one way to take it into account. And I'll turn to that in the next slide. Just give me one second. It'll be clear in a bit.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in the limit that the T2G EG splitting goes off to infinity, in fact, this splitting that I'm writing here will go to zero. Okay. So what we find is you can sort of write out the wave functions of this doublet here, and they in the JZ quantum numbers are simply JZ equal to zero and a linear combination of JZ plus minus two. And here I'm putting in my hand that the splitting is on the scale of about 20 millivolts. Okay. And let's see kind of what, you know, what we can understand simply from this hypothesis, and we'll justify it in a bit. Okay. So one thing we see is that this doublet here is a non-Kramer's doublet, which means that they are not, these two levels are not connected by time reversal symmetry. They are in fact, you know, degenerate because you have a cubic system. And so this crystal symmetry is important in protecting this degeneracy in the problem, not time reversal. Okay. We also see from here that if you act the spin operator, you know, S plus minus SZ on these levels, in fact, there are no matrix elements between these two. And so in fact, there will be nothing to do with dipole order within this doublet. So what you expect is that if you act the S plus, S minus, or SZ, in fact, you will create an excitation that must take you from this non-Kramer's doublet into this magnetic triplet. Okay. And so already you see from here that we can understand a bunch of things in the with the data, right? So this entropy clearly is, you know, if this is large, it's, you know, over 200 Kelvin. The entropy that you're going to see is the log 2 entropy and not the log 5 coming from all 5. We expect a spin gap, which, as I mentioned, is seen in the inelastic neutron data. Okay. And finally, there's no dipole degrees of freedom here. And so, of course, you don't expect any dipole moment ordering to be seen in the experiment. Okay. So this is the you know, proposal that we had. And we can sort of kind of examine the question that Leo just raised. So you can ask, well, where does this come from? And really, this comes from the fact that, you know, we assume that this crystal field splitting is so large that I'll throw it away and focus on how spin orbit coupled and interactions and spin orbit coupling scramble these levels and or entangle them to form your J equal to 2 manifold. Yeah. And that turns out to be actually dangerous, because in this particular instance, there are terms, the spin orbit coupling, of course, couples all the levels of the d orbital angular momentum. And so there is in particular a term in perturbation theory where you have to go to third order, where the in the non-interacting problem where you excite through spin orbit coupling, you excite one electron up into the EG level. And then these electrons have some intermediate state interaction due to Hund's coupling, and finally it comes back via spin orbit. And so there is a term at cubic order, which is JH times lambda square. Sorry, there's a typo here. It should be V square, which is the crystal field splitting. And if you put in numbers, it turns out that you get something depending on this splitting here, you get some number that is in the right ballpark. So it's kind of, you can get some splittings on the scale of, sorry, this delta here is actually this splitting here. As it gets larger, this is mislabeled. This axis is mislabeled here. So this splitting here, 8 millivolts here, refers to the splitting between the doublet and triplet that I was referring to. And you can see that when the original T2G EG splitting gets very large, this effective splitting of the doublet and triplet basically vanishes. Okay. So this x-axis has been mislabeled. So this then you can understand. So there is some microscopic justification for doing this, namely that people typically ignore this, and that's not safe to do if one is looking at the question that we are interested in. So with that, you can now look at sort of what these degrees of freedom are at low energy. So let's forget about the triplet now and start thinking about the ordering and the physics of the low energy doublet. And you can now write out sort of what the different components of angular momentum are. Yeah, Leo.
Yeah, sorry, another question.
Yeah, no.
Can you see this experimentally, that if you go to, you know, let's say above 200 Kelvin, that there's, you know, around 200 Kelvin, that there's this.
All five?
Yeah, exactly. Can you see that?
So that they have not actually done the subtraction and gotten that. So they should do that, really. Yeah, I agree.
Okay. That's feasible. Okay.
Yeah, Bruce, sorry, maybe Bruce already has an answer to that. I see he's...
Well, I was just going to say that the higher in temperature you go, the more difficult it is to isolate the phonon contribution, because it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger very quickly. And so doing that subtraction at 200 Kelvin is somewhat difficult, much more difficult than doing it at 50 Kelvin.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
So I think there was one more.
Actually, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
So what about the external magnetic field effects? So if you have this scheme, then perhaps the response to the external field is very different between this picture and the original picture?
Yeah, it is, yeah.
So, and in principle, one could detect something like induced dipole moment or something starting from this ground state by applying a field.
Right, one can. So I think one of the challenges, is the fact that there haven't been, one thing is that there haven't been large single crystals for this. So it's kind of, I think, hard, because one expects that there will be a strong directional dependent field response, as you know, from the other heavy fermion examples. And so similar direction dependent response should be there. I think it's just that there are no large single crystals of these to do experiments. I think even with field, it would be worth doing experiments.
Yeah, in principle, that could be some simple chat, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Bruce, sorry, did you raise your hand to respond to?
No. I was just going to agree with everything. It would be we can't grow the single crystals, but it would be a good idea to do with the powders anyway. We just haven't done it yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So certainly the field response you would expect is the field response for any accessible fields would be coming from the doublet with some weak mixing with the triplet induced by the magnetic field. So that would be the response one would expect to look for. All right, so now you can ask, well, what are the operators that connect these doublets, right? So in the in the basis that I was writing them in, tau z is simply the z square minus j square. So this of course is labeled by the jz quantum numbers 0 and 2 plus minus 2 that I was writing down earlier. The ones that induce transitions between those basis states are tau x, which is an orthogonal sort of quadrupole, and tau y, which is a symmetrized combination of three angular momentum operators. Okay. So you see from here that these two are exactly like the EG orbitals in some sense, right? They are like the z square and the x square minus y square. Orbitals. So in fact, that picture that I was mentioning to think of this doublet as an EG and the triplet, magnetic triplet as an P2G, is kind of borne out by this picture here. This kind of reflects that. This one here, tau y, is a time reversal odd, and that corresponds to an Ising-like magnetic octopole. So it can have, of course, you can take on values plus minus one if you do break time reversal by giving an expectation value to this octopole. And these are time reversal even, and they form like an XY-like quadrupolar charge density or some kind of orbital order in the system. Okay. So in fact, this is not the first place where this kind of physics is seen. There's a lot of work on heavy fermion compounds. Most notably, there's been a lot of work from Satoru Nakatsuji's group examining this in the context of these praseodymium compounds, 4F systems, where you have them in these moments live on a diamond lattice, effective diamond lattice. And there's been a lot of work from Jongbeck's group and theory from Sunetsugu, Hattori and Sunetsugu, and a lot of experimental work on this from Nakatsuji's group here. So now we can, so with that, let me kind of ask a couple of other questions now. What does this imply for other experiments, right? So we kind of see that we can rationalize some of the data. We can start asking about, can one understand the other experimental results? And then can one kind of look forward and think about kind of predictions that one could make for other types of experiments that could be done to, further test this scenario? So one of the things we see from is this kind of not really a test of the type of order, but it's really looking at this inelastic neutron scattering type experiments. And you say, well, if what you have is a doublet that has no dipole magnetic degrees of freedom, then a neutron necessarily comes in and it has to create an excitation through coupling to the neutrons. You're basically excited from the doublet into the triplet. And that tells us that there is some kind of a magnetic exciton in the problem, which can be at low energies, it can be like 15, 20 millivolt energy scales. And that is kind of this bright spot here, should remind you of kind of this bright spot in the inelastic neutron scattering experiments that I was showing at the beginning. Okay, so there is some kind of low energy magnetic exciton in the problem. Okay, so that's consistent with this spin gap inelastic data. The other thing is you can ask, well, what does the mu SR, measure then? And this is actually very reminiscent of things which people have seen proposed, for instance, in the cube rates or in strontium ruthenium oxide, where you say, well, there is some kind of current or orbital currents, not magnetic order, but really some orbital currents, which can give rise to weak fields in mu SR. And in fact, one can sort of do this calculation here very simply by just assuming that there is a certain, some wave functions, some atomic wave functions that you have to put in here, but it's really saying that there is this combination of, the zero and the two plus minus two, those, there is some combination that orders and that gives rise to orbital currents. And you can sort of estimate the field at the muon site, which is close to the oxygen. And you find that the field scales are kind of within a factor of two of what is measured. So I think the measurements are like about 50 Gauss, and we get something like 30 Gauss from this very crude estimate. So that's kind of also in line. And one can then ask for, you know, what else one might see. And in particular, one experiment that I think might be worth doing, given all the other NMR work that's been done on these class of compounds. There's been extensive NMR work on the heavy fermion praseodymium compounds I was mentioning, but also on the D1 systems from Vesna Mitrovic and Ian Fisher. They had like a series of papers kind of where Vesna had done NMR measurements looking for this kind of orbital and magnetic orders, looking for electric field gradients in NQR, but also looking at magnetism in these systems. And one can imagine doing something similar with these systems. And so what we've looked at is, you know, what do you expect, for instance, if one were to do oxygen NMR? So oxygen, remember, is sitting between the osmium, which is magnetically active, and some inert, like magnesium or calcium or whatever, and it's sitting in between. And it's sitting on a line where there is some kind of an effective C4 symmetry. But the fields that are produced by osmium are, you know, when you do have this octopole order, are such that, in fact, the fields are expected to cancel out if you're sitting exactly on that C4 axis. Okay. So what you expect is that you should go through this time reversal symmetry breaking transition, but somehow it should not be visible in NMR, oxygen NMR. But if you do something to distort the system by hand, so imagine you apply strain or something to distort the system so that you break C4 symmetry, then there should be an effective field generated you know, at the oxygen site, which is proportional to the degree of distortion, right? So that's one you know, signature that might be possibly something that one can explore. The other is has to do with Raman scattering, which is you can sort of try and ask, you know, can I generate some kind of a peak where I can look at transitions between, let's say, either between the doublet and the triplet, which certainly, you know, kind of experiments that a lot of people, including people like Gersh Bloomberg, for instance, quite routinely do for looking at crystal field levels in these systems. But one can also look at sort of how a magnetic field changes the scenario. And if there is octopolar order, it turns out that there is actually a quasi-elastic peak at low energy, which really reflects the fact that if I apply a magnetic field, then in some sense, I break the cubic symmetry down to tetragonal in some sense. The field picks a direction and reduces the symmetry from cubic to tetragonal, let's say point along the Z direction. And that induces a non-zero quadrupole order in the system if octopole moment is non-zero. Okay, so the octopole multiplied by the field effectively gives you some kind of quadrupole order. And that should show up as a quasi-elastic signal. There's an interesting variant of this that was actually proposed long ago by Boris Chaiman, Sriram Shastri, and others, where they had proposed that, you know, if you have spin chirality, so if you have scalar spin chirality, it turns out that actually has a very similar quasi-elastic response that one expects. So in fact, this octopole order in some sense bears some interesting resemblance to this kind of scalar spin chirality order. So there is some useful analogies to be made. So let me then turn to, you know, last few slides. Actually, let me turn to sort of what we have done to further kind of justify this thing, right? So earlier what I mentioned was just the single site problem where we were looking at the levels, why the five-fold splits into a 2 and 3. But one can ask, well, you know, are the exchange interactions actually consistent with octopole ordering in the pump, right? So I didn't talk about how these should order. We just assume that there is some kind of octopole ordering. But very recently, you know, my student and postdoc, they kind of did this very nice calculation where you can, you know, just look at the two site problem and you can sort of put in the, you know, take the microscopic model that, you know, T2GEG, and you just put in hopping between the sites and you can extract the coupling. So it turns out it's a little bit, Chandra.
Yeah, perhaps I'm harking back to this question of inducing some coupling between the T2G and the EG. So imagine that, as you're saying, you stay cubic, then am I correct that this will not happen with any local or on-site interactions?
Oh, no, no. So, sorry. So the T2G EG mixing that I was talking about was not that you generate. So it's not like giving an expectation value to T2G Dagger EG. I was just saying that there could be virtual excitations even in the cubic system where you excite.
You're looking for an instability, but to do that, wouldn't you need to have, because the on-site thing is exactly diagonalized. There's nothing virtual left to do.
Great.
So unless there are some induced interactions of higher order,
right,
you're not going to split the local. You cannot change the local physics.
Right. So what
is single ion level?
Yeah, correct. So at the single ion, what I was referring to with
certain,
okay, sure.
I'm really asking how you get around that.
Right. So what I'm saying here is, in fact, when we talk about the single ion physics, the perturbation theory that I was referring to is with respect to the non-interacting top, right? So if I take non-interacting T2G and EG, just say it's crystal field physics, electron interactions don't play a role, then I define my T2G and EG degrees of freedom, right? And now I'm doing perturbation theory. So instead of doing the exact including interactions and spin orbit coupling exactly, let's say I were to do perturbation theory, right? Then in fact, there are perturbative processes which involve virtual excitations into the EG and coming back. So it's perturbing with respect to the non-interacting comp, was what I was referring to. So some degree of freedom, you can sort of take into account all the interactions within the T2G, right? But then say that I have omitted in that calculation virtual excitations going into the EG and back. And so that's the second thing that we need to keep, or you can directly solve the full five orbital problem. So both of them give the exact same result. Either you completely diagonalize this, then you get the doublet and triplet, as I was mentioning, with the five orbitals, or you only solve the T2G problem with interactions and then account for virtual excitations into the EG through perturbation theory, and both give the exact same ones. So all of that I was mentioning to with respect to how these levels split is very much one-site physics for generating the non-criminal doublet. Now the question is, how do these doublets end up ordering? And for that, we have to actually ask, what is the exchange interaction between the doublets on neighboring sites?
I guess that's precisely what I was saying. I cannot see any ordering occurring of the kind that you are talking about from single site, many bodies.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, absolutely. So there is a non-Kramer's doublet that I generate, but for the ordering is what I was just going to turn to. So there is an ordering that must appear once you start taking into account inter-site coupling between these non-Kramer's doublets. That's right. Right. So earlier we just hypothesized it, and I'm just going to spend a slide or two just mentioning what we find from microscopic calculations. Good point. So what we've done here is now take into account sort of, so the two sites. So imagine I take one particular plane of my cubic crystal. Then, you know, it was a checkerboard pattern. So it just means that, you know, if I have a square, for example, in one particular layer, then the sites that I'm interested in sit on this checkerboard pattern. So they sit on sites which are on the diagonals of the square. And now you can take into account all possible hopping. So there are some, you know, the dominant hopping is some things where these orbitals directly point to each other, some XY orbitals. Then there are some subdominant hoppings which actually turn out to be important. And what we find is that this blue curve here ref is the calculated octopolar exchange. And the other two, the brown and yellow curves here, actually represent the quadrupolar coupling. And what we find is that, in fact, once you can sort of very easily tune yourself with these subdominant couplings into a regime where you get large negative octopolar coupling. So what I mean is ferro-octopolar coupling dominates over these quadrupole couplings in this problem. And so you can sort of look at sort of what, and then of course, what we did was just, you know, take those couplings and one can do like a classical Monte Carlo and we find this very large peak corresponding to the a single transition. And, you know, here I've just picked some microscopic parameters that puts us, gives us a TC if it's kind of in the right ballpark that's seen in the experiments. Yonglin, yeah.
So what's the reason behind such a big gradient, big change in the octopolar interaction?
This one here?
Right. Why they don't change so much compared to quadrupolar part?
Yeah, so this one, okay. So it turns out that the quadrupolar part actually, okay. So maybe I can... okay, I don't know if I can annotate here. But okay, so it turns out that there's a doublet and a nearby triplet, right? And it turns out that if you take into account the exchange to leading order in second order perturbation theory, it turns out that you actually get this octopolar exchange to be quite large in this window. The quadrupolar, it turns out, actually gets two competing terms. So it turns out that there is one term that comes from only doing second order perturbation theory, where you go from doublet to doublet and back. Right. So you go from, you go from the D2 to D2 and come back, but you project your entire second order perturbation theory into those doublets. Right. But it turns out that there are actually fourth order processes which become important because the splitting is extremely small scale. So what you get are, so in other words, you know, what I should be really thinking of it is that this symmetry breaking is so small between the five levels that effectively it's as if I have a spin two problem, right? I have two spin two problems. I'll kind of couple them and come back. And now what I have is a big matrix of, you know, these spin two interactions. And the naive thing to do is to just project that interaction into the doublet sector. And that actually reasonably works well, reasonably for the octopolar. But it turns out that for the quadrupolar, in fact, you have to do this projection carefully. You have to actually do perturbation theory where you can have virtual excitations into the local triplet and come back. So it turns out that there's a very strong renormalization of the quadrupolar coupling. When this gap, the doublet triplet gap is small, it turns out the quadrupole interactions are very strongly renormalized.
Are you saying that there are lots of cancellation between
the quadrupole? Yeah, there are cancellations for the quadrupole, but the octopole does not have those cancellations.
I see.
Yeah.
Like how high order you should go to
so series? To fourth order, I think it already captures some of the physics. So roughly speaking, you know, you compute it as if it was a five-fold degenerate level, right? The thing is very simple, right? So you compute it as if it was a five-fold degenerate level, but then you recognize that in fact there's a weak splitting, right? So then you have to just take into account an order J squared divided by delta, where delta is the splitting. Then there's an order. So J, let's say, is your bare magnetic exchange, which is some gamma, let's like some gamma matrix model, right? Then what you get are, in addition, then you what you get are kind of virtual excitations into the triplet and back, which happen at order J squared divided by delta. So if you do it in terms of hopping, you have to go to fourth order in hopping.
I see.
Or if you do it in terms of exchange divided by the splitting, it's second order in the effective exchange.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, KM.
Yeah, so maybe I can comment on that part.
Sure. Yeah.
You don't have to do the J equal 2. You can do it T2G, and you can do the EG. Mm-hmm. And take the T2G as a virtual process.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do it second order, you can show that this minor exchange terms generate the ferro octopole. But that's not enough, significant enough to give you the octopolar order. But then you go to the high order, so you need the two stages of process. One process is this intra-orbital coupling that requires to make a ferro octuple because this is an FCC lattice, which is highly frustrated. Then what you do is that you actually take the T2G triplet excitations as a virtual process, which will enhance your ferro octopolar exchange further. Then you cross the phase boundary between the anti-ferro quadrupole to a ferro octopole.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
so by the fourth order, that's captured. So you don't have to go back to your J equal 2.
Yeah. What I meant was the J equal to 2 refers to kind of, you know, keeping all 5 levels degenerate and computing an exchange interaction. And then you can sort of do, it's the same thing. I think you can do it to either fourth order in the hopping or to second order in some effective exchange of the J equal to 2. Maybe you can discuss this further, because I know that you and your student have been looking at this as well. So, yeah. Leo, sorry.
Yeah, I'm a little confused. Why is the exchange computed only, if I understand correctly, for the two sides on the diagonal, but not on the bond?
Oh, no, it's just that this particular crystal, the way I've drawn this lattice is that these are the osmium sites, and then these are some other ions.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, yeah, I see.
So this is this checkerboard pattern. So this is, you know, these are the osmium, and these are just some completely different, like magnesium, some inert stuff.
I see. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm.
So what we find is, in fact, you know, depending on the hoppings, and here, of course, we are not doing a microscopic calculation of the hoppings, but there are some reasonable choices of these small hoppings. And what we find is that there's a fairly large regime of ferro-octopolar order. And in fact, there is some nice work, you know, from LDA-DMFT from a group in Italy, but it's a little bit of a black box. So I haven't been able to really, you know, disentangle exactly what goes in, what comes out is kind of hard to see. But there is some very nice work from Heyang's group where they've actually used density functional theory, I guess in the second paper here, where they've used density functional theory to make estimates of what these hoppings are. And there was some preprint that they put out where I think they'd gone to second order and they discovered this thing that quadrupole dominates over octopole. But I mean, from what I know, I think they've kind of reworked it, and they are, I don't know what the latest is, but I think that they are also finding the octopole kind of order, as far as I could tell from a very brief chat with Heyang some couple of weeks ago. So this is just showing that, you know, you can sort of get, you know, reasonable TCs, as I was mentioning earlier. And so what I wanted to spend, you know, last couple of minutes was really talking about, you know, how one can take the system and drive it towards quantum criticality. Okay? So there's some very, very cute work from Akash Maharaj et al. In this paper here, which was a collaboration with Ian Fisher, Steve Kivelson, and Erisberg, Raphael, I think like a whole bunch of people involved, where they were looking at examples where you have nematic order. So that's some kind of a quadrupolar order in the system which breaks directional symmetry. So let's say you're a square lattice and you pick one direction out of two, so some kind of an Ising quadrupole. And what you can do is you can apply strains in the system that actually act as a transverse field on this particular Ising quadrupole. And so we're asking, you know, can one do something similar for these non-Kramer's doublets that we're encountering here? Okay. And it turns out that because these non-Kramer's doublets are protected by crystal symmetry, okay, it turns out that, you know, if you have this octopole order, it's like a tau y order in the system from the definition that I had. But if you could generate a field proportional to tau x or tau z, then that would be like a transverse field on this Ising octopole. Okay. And it turns out that that's very easy to do, because you have a non-Kramer's doublet. Anytime you break cubic symmetry, you will naturally generate something that breaks this doublet. And so it turns out there are multiple ways to generate transverse fields in the problem. Okay. So one way is to say, well, imagine I take a cubic crystal and I look at the surface. Okay. Then on the surface, it turns out that if you recompute this two-site exchange, it turns out that not every plane on the cubic lattice basically contributes. There's a special plane at the surface. And it turns out that in addition to the exchange interactions, you can compute using the same two-site calculation. It turns out that there's actually a very large transverse field corresponding to tau z, a magnetic field acting on tau z. Okay. And so now you can ask what happens. So imagine I have a very large, you know, almost like a bulk system, but with surfaces, then there will be a surface term, which there is a transverse field at the surface on this octopole order, right? And depending on the strength of that field, it could be that, you know, the system at the surface, it could be, for example, in a paramagnetic phase, where this octopole order is lost at the surface, right? Or if there is some way to tune the surface physics, then maybe one can actually take that surface towards quantum criticality. So you can have that the bulk has some kind of octopole order, but the surface you can induce quantum phase transitions. Okay. The other possibility is you can say, well, you know, imagine I have a large surface magnetic field. It's going to actually decay into the bulk, you know, some distance given by the correlation length, right? And so if you bring these two surfaces very close to each other, you can actually turn the entire system from octopolar order into a paramagnet, which is polarized along the tau z direction. Right? So this is just an example where if you take the exact same Hamiltonian that we had earlier, compute the transverse fields at the surface, and then just take the thin film and kind of go down in size from, you know, 5 layers to 3 to 2 to 1, then TC basically comes marching down. And eventually TC vanishes for the thinnest film systems in this particular case with, you know, bilayer or monolayer or bilayer, it vanishes. So as you can see that TC comes down as you decrease the thickness, and that's a kind of manifestation of this transverse field acting on the octopole. Another way is to apply some kind of a strain in the system. So what we're assuming is, let's say I can sort of take a uniaxial. So imagine I have a single crystal, right? And I can apply uniaxial strain on the system, let's say along the Z direction. And let's imagine that I can do it along, yeah, Chandra, sorry, there's a question.
What was happening in the previous slide where, presumably you're plotting CV divided by temperature or something, I mean, CV cannot be independent of temperature as temperature is going to zero.
Sorry.
What are you putting here?
Sorry, so I should have mentioned. So this was actually a study, just a classical Monte Carlo study at this point, right? So this here.
Classically, you can get everything. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, so this entropy will eventually, of course, the specific heat will vanish in the quantum problem. Right. And so this should be viewed as an estimate of the phase transition and how it changes. So thanks for that. So in the spin half system, if you really do this for the quantum problem, we expect that maybe qualitatively this physics might remain unaffected. But of course, this entropy that comes from, you know, in the classical problem, it's the two transverse degrees of freedom, you know, away from the octopole, and that should actually go to zero in the full quantum problem. Right, so this is just an estimate, but we expect that this physics will survive because it's some fairly straightforward transverse fieldizing model physics in a film. That's the you know, relevant thing to think about here. With strain, it's kind of, we've done like a toy calculation again. So we're just assuming that if you compress or expand the system, let's assuming that all the hoppings along one direction basically are tuned by some ratio that you know, this is not the, this is like an overly simplistic view of what strain does in a real problem, but let's take that as, you know, it's convenient to think about, you know, compressing the system to, you know, have stronger interlayer coupling versus kind of have effectively a 2D limit when the layers get very far away. And in that case, we can sort of track what this also breaks cubic symmetry. Okay? And again, it leads to transverse fields. And we find that, you know, depending on the degree of, so this delta here is not the strain. The strain will be some small fraction of delta. We find that, you know, you can change the TC significantly if you can sort of achieve in this effective delta on the scale of several the same, like 20% for this effective hopping. And again, there are experiments of the sort that people have been doing on the 214 ruthenates, and it might be kind of interesting to explore this physics in some of these systems as well. Okay. So with that, I'll end. So just leave the summary up here, and if there are any additional questions, I'm happy to take them.
So yeah, thank you, Arun, for a very nice talk. We had a lot of questions during the talk, but are there any further questions? Can I? Yeah. Oh, Chandra has a question. Yeah.
Are there parameters where you can get these currents happening within a given site as opposed to between sites? You know, the kind of things that Lovesey talks about.
Yeah.
What would be the parameter which would give you one rather than the other? Do you see my question?
Yeah, so right now the currents actually that I was referring to were assuming that there's a broken symmetry generated by these exchange interactions. Then you can almost think of it as an order parameter generated at a single site, right? So these loop currents that I was referring to are really currents going around in some sense a single atom with its oxygen octahedral kit. So those currents were, this was just one atom and, it's octahedral kit. So these are almost kind of localized in some sense to one atom.
But when you are considering inter-site exchange interactions, that will also generate a coherent contribution of current from one side to the other. And my question really is,
we have not
an idea of the parameters required which favor one rather than the other or both.
Yeah. So right now we do expect
This is closer to what Lovsey talks about.
Yeah. So right now we have not computed the inter-site currents in the system. So right now I assumed that's a good point. So this calculation that I was mentioning that roughly captures the mu SR. Was thinking about just loop currents in some sense at a single site in the surrounding oxygen environment. But the hope was that those inter-site currents might be weaker because these are, spaced apart further, for example, compared to the cube rates where they are just nearest neighbors on the square lattice here, it's like second neighbor. So it's possible that those inter-site loop currents are weaker, but I don't know. We have not actually computed them.
I had a question about the mu SR. To get any magnitude of the field, you have to know pretty well where the muon is sitting.
Right.
Like that known? I mean, usually, the muon will be sitting on the oxygen site where you said there is no magnetic moment.
Oh, no. So the muon is not going to sit exactly on the oxygen. So it's going to be sitting in the vicinity of the oxygen. The
muon has a very large mass. It's 200 electrons. So it's less than an angstrom below the most negatively charged object that you have, which is the oxygen in this case.
Correct. So we put it at about a 3/4 of an angstrom or an angstrom away. Yeah. So we had looked at, this we actually got from discussions with Graham Luke, who's been thinking about this in other systems as well. So we were not exactly sure where the landing spot is for these muons. And I think people do density functional theory calculations to estimate the optimal spot where the muon is going to actually sit. So here we had not done that. We estimated that it would sit about some distance of about half an angstrom to an angstrom away from oxygen.
That's the kind of right estimate, but I wanted to, what I was puzzled about was that, as you mentioned, on the oxygen site,
correct,
there is zero, there will be no magnetic field.
Correct. So if you're exactly on that symmetry axis, then it vanishes. But if you're off symmetry, this distance here, so this osmium here oxygen is a couple of angstroms. And if you're away by half an angstrom, it's kind of a substantial angle with respect to. So C4 is kind of very strongly broken by the time you're half an angstrom.
So you, at 3/4 an angstrom from an oxygen, you can get this value, this kind of value for the field from an orbital moment, you can get that. Is that
correct? Okay.
And
partly it's aided by the fact that the 5D wave functions are more spread out compared to the very localized atomic wave functions for the 3D. Mm-hmm. So that helps a little bit with getting the currents to kind of have a larger extent and play a bigger role at this distance.
Thank you.
Hei Young had a question.
I have a question about mu SR as well. So if the muon comes in, as you discussed, it'll sit near the oxygen. Mm-hmm. And is it possible that because it's a positively charged, it might distort slightly the oxygen site, which is sufficient enough to generate the dipole moment? With the triplets, and the triplet moment will be, your wave function is going to be modified.
Yeah.
Yeah, then I wonder if the 50 Gauss is rather large compared to octapolar moment of 30 Gauss. I think 30 Gauss is your maximum, and back of your blue circle, probably the minima is probably even smaller. And is it possible that there are some dipole component in the wave function?
It could be. So in fact, I mean, the other thing which I've never really understood in these systems, of course, you know, if the muon sits at a site, and I think this is true in a lot of these non-Kramer systems, the muon comes and sits here, of course, you know, the Coulomb interaction should also split this non-Kramer's doublet, right? Yeah. Just the Coulomb field of an ion sitting here that breaks E4 symmetry, right? So in fact, I don't think it, so mu SR might be trickier to think about in this system, you know, partly what you said is true. So if you break C4 symmetry, you know, you don't have a cubic problem anymore, right? And so you could mix the doublet and triplet. You could also split the doublet itself. So this, I think, is kind of, in some sense, a little bit, it was helpful in that, you know, if I'd gotten something like one Gauss, it would have been crazy. But it looked like, okay, it's within a factor of two. So hopefully it's kind of a useful starting point to think about this. But yeah, you're right. I mean, it's not quantitatively accurate. And certainly, I think it's not something which I would think is we understand completely. And I think Leo had another question. Sorry, I thought I saw his hand raised, but...
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Yeah. I've seen papers saying that in D5 materials, there can also be multiple states. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so I think the only way you could get something like that maybe is somehow this atomic limit picture is not quite true, right? So you could imagine, you know, because you have strong mixing with the oxygens, or that it's really close to being a metal, that in fact there is some very strong, you know, mixing between what you call J1/2 and J3/2, that in fact these wave functions are not as well isolated as we would like to think. And certainly I think there is evidence from DFT, and I think maybe even Heyang has done some of these calculations and the iridates, is that there is certainly, I don't think this picture of a perfect J1/2 doublet is, you know, valid except in some extreme Mott limit. So that might be part of the reason why people have invoked it. I don't know of a specific, you know, thing that I can point to,
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Well, if not, let's thank Arun again.
Thanks, everyone.